Welcome to the latest episode of the People Will Talk podcast. Joining me in studio is Maria. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. You?
I'm very good, thank you. And special guest, James Hartley. How are you, James?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me here today. And Maria, it's a real pleasure.
The pleasure is all ours. And there's so much to ask you about. And I really want to ask you to start off about your international background. You're a Liverpudlian by birth, but you've ended up in Madrid, of course, and in between you've been to Oman and Singapore. So I guess this question is a bit two-pronged. Like, what has this international existence been like, and why did you eventually settle here in the Spanish capital?
It's been crazy, actually. So I lived the first 7 years of my life in near Liverpool, on the other side of the Mersey. And then because of my dad's job, we traveled. So I went to Singapore first, lived there for about 4 or 5 years. After that, Scotland for a year, Oman after that, Muscat. And then I went to university in London. And then I just started traveling around again. Went to France, lived in Ireland, in Galway for a bit, for 2 years.
Oh, wow.
And then popped up in Madrid one day because of a friend, I think. And so I was teaching by then, teaching English. And I loved it. I loved the city, and I fell in love as well with a girl here. And really, that was it. It was both things. It was perfect. I don't know. I'd never had really that feeling before. Maybe at home, this felt like another home. And that was it. That, since then, that's me. I'm here and Madrid and married, 2 kids, and that's me now. That's the story.
That's very nice that it feels like home now after you've been to so many places. Some of them are so exotic. So
it's weird. It's weird because sometimes, I feel like it is home. I'm not really. I don't know. I feel like everywhere is home wherever I am. I know that sounds like a cliche, but I don't get sort of sentimental about stuff. But I love Madrid. Sometimes I feel really I wouldn't say Spanish, but I feel really at home. And then other times, if I have a cup of tea, everybody says I'm super English. If it rains, everybody says I must love the weather. But then if I go home, everybody sort of says, oh, now that you're Spanish, you know, so I'm not really anything. I'm stuck in the middle, but I definitely feel like this place is my home, and I love it here.
It's quite interesting because it seems to, we've interviewed quite a lot of people that have ended up living here in Madrid for one reason or another. Some of them only came for a couple of days and then just stayed here for years. It's quite funny. Well, I think probably, and that might be able to empathize with that a little bit as well, how, you know, in the end, like here, you're not completely one thing, but then when you go back home, you're not completely the other. So it's mostly good.
You know what? It's mostly good because you kind of, now that I've got kids and of course their mom is Spanish and I'm English, we always say to them, look, you got the best of both worlds. You know what I mean? You don't have to choose. I think it's a lesson for life. Sometimes you feel like you're constantly being made to choose, and there's no, you can have both or a lot of things. Why can't you have an English breakfast and then tortilla de patatas for lunch? I don't know. Do you know what I mean? Why does it have to be one better than the other? I don't see it. And with regards to Asia or even the Middle East or anything, I think everywhere's beautiful. Scotland, Ireland was amazing. The West Coast, Scotland was beautiful. I don't know. I don't know. I don't like the thing of like you have to choose. But it's true that sometimes you don't feel, you know, of a place, maybe. Like recently in the European football, you know, everyone's like, oh, you must be worried about England. I'm like, well, no, not really. Oh, you must be supporting Spain. Well, no, not really. I don't mind. I like football. You know, I can't really win. So I don't know. A bit like that.
Okay, well, I will let you say that you weren't supporting Spain just for this once.
I was wearing a Spanish top, and my wife was wearing an English top. So I'm going to go with that.
Oh, dear.
We won.
Fair enough. Well, you mentioned your kids. I think they're teenagers, maybe, around that age?
Very much.
Yeah. But actually, we wanted to ask you, because you have written a couple of books, haven't you, for like young adults? It feels like you know, teenagers are getting it gets earlier and earlier, basically, that they become teenagers. Speaking just from my nephews and nieces, that's the case. But when it comes to young adults, I don't know what made you be interested in that audience, and do you think it's particularly challenging? Is it very different from writing other kinds of books?
I don't know. Why did I do it? Because I wanted to. Years ago, I studied Macbeth, the Shakespeare book, when I was at school, and I had no idea about Shakespeare. Thought it was boring. Blah blah blah. Had a really good teacher. And loved the play, loved it. Like, it just, lights came on. And, you know, I mean, when you read a poem, if someone explains it to you, or sometimes a novel or a book or a painting, anything, if someone explains a little bit to you about it and gives you the key, it's a totally different experience sometimes. And for me, that happened with Macbeth, the play. So I'd always had that in my mind. I'd also been to a boarding school, because when we were in Oman, my parents decided, okay, look, you're going to have to go to a boarding school to do your exams. Because the school level wasn't good enough at that time to take sort of university exams. So I'd come from Liverpool, like a normal working class, upper working class, just about middle class background. And suddenly I was in a boarding school, you know? So I also had that experience. So I tried to mix the two. So it made sense to me to write it for people about 13, 14, 15, who might have to study Shakespeare plays, who might be interested in the kind of boarding school. I liked, you know, Harry Potter was big. I used to read Enid Blyton books when I was a kid, like the whole boarding school-y kind of thing, magic boarding school. So it kind of, once I had those two things, it wrote itself, the books. And then I thought, okay, they're at a school, they're reading Macbeth, they go into the play, for some magical reason they can, and then in the second book, Shakespeare was a student at the school because there's some lost years of his life and so on. I wrote it kind of that way. But I do think these days teenagers, the range of books that they can choose from is amazing, absolutely amazing. I mean, there's so many. If you like vampires, boarding school vampires who are actually mermaids, there's probably 150 books like that. Do you know what I mean? And there's always three or four of each one. It's amazing.
This whole Shakespeare thing is really interesting, because I think there's a bit of a debate now if Shakespeare he's too entrenched in the curriculum of different countries, and that maybe as important as he is, of course, there's no one denying that maybe there should be space for other books. As you said yourself, there's so many books out there. Do you feel that Shakespeare could be maybe the spotlight on him could be reduced?
Personally, no, because I'm a fan. And I'd say that really, I know how it sounds. I do agree that there's a couple of books. I mean, we could sit here all day, and there's quite a few books that I think get repeated over and over. The Shakespeare thing, there's two Shakespeares, because there's kind of the William Shakespeare, you know, you think of the plays and Gielgud and that way of speaking, which isn't even the way the plays were spoken. He comes, if you've been to Stratford's nowhere near London. It's got nothing to do with London or sort of posh. The plays are nothing to do with sort of poshy, snobby. It's nothing to do with that, really. It's hard to explain. It's a bit like what's happened to Cervantes, to Don Quixote here, you know? It's become like this sort of monolith that's kind of scary to see. But really, it doesn't represent, when you read it, it's nothing to do with that. So Shakespeare, no, because I think there's so much life in it that I think his way of seeing the world was still, at least in, like, I still don't think there's much better than him. But I agree with you that in some cases, for me, the sort of turning him into this, Shakespeare. That I agree with. That I think is rubbish. But studying a bit of him, no, I think it's, as far as English literature goes, I would defend him. But that's just me personally. I get the idea that it's old and you know. But no, I disagree. I know I'm a bit sound like a, but no, I got a lot of time for him. Still don't know much better, you know, at least in written in English.
I think that's fair enough. Like, he is definitely an amazing writer. In my opinion, it'd be great to see other, I think, you know, for example, he was on the run for a few years as a, you know, in a Protestant country as a Catholic. Wasn't yeah. he kind of, there's part of his life that I think is very dramatic and very interesting, that it'd be interesting to open up other facets of his life and have definitely. Content about that, you know. But I think what's interesting about what you said is that it's about opening up the language. And this kind of links to the question I wanted to ask you about being the associate editor of Tint Journal, which you are.
Yeah.
And what this is interesting is, like, it's a literary journal where all the contributors are writing in English, but English is their second language. And yeah, it has it's so amazing. And its mission is essentially to build cultural bridges and showcase that non-native speakers can write powerfully, because they're choosing their words more precisely. I mean, it's so wonderful. This could you just tell us more about this project?
Yeah, basically, I love books and writing and sort of that. So working in Spain, obviously, I did some books for the school. I just get the feeling sometimes that I don't know the literary world, the bits that I see, it's quite closed off. And again, it's a bit like Shakespeare. They show one side of it, and it's all a bit ivory towery, I don't know, or it's closed off, or it seems that way, I don't know. So anyway, I was looking through, is there a magazine for, you know, like, if I had some good students at school who can write brilliant poetry in English or brilliant stories, looking for somewhere for them. Sometimes people send me stuff to James, what can I do with this, blah blah blah. So I was looking through and I found it, and it comes out of the University of Vienna, I think it is. They have like a grant to run it. And I contacted them, really asking them where do I send things? And also just straight up, guys, do you have any, I'm interested in the project. And they wrote back and said, well, look, we always need, well, you're lucky there's an editor is gone or whatever, you know, one of the good timing things. And so I joined last year, I think. And great. I mean, it's amazing. The stories are brilliant, you know, and they have a very clear kind of editing policy. I mean, it's very much leave things as they are, you know. I mean, English is English. It's just different. For me, the beautiful thing is it's different experiences recorded, you know, different points of view, different ways of writing as well. But I don't really feel, when I read it, you don't feel it's anything strange or I don't know. It's just stories and poems, and I just think it's a lovely idea. I don't know. It's an interesting, I enjoy doing it, and it's really interesting work, I guess you'd call it. But it's I think it's a great initiative.
Murakami, yes,
I completely agree. Yeah. Sorry,
Marie. No, sorry. I was just going to say Murakami famously wrote his first novel in English as a way to excise all the unnecessary elements from the story. And
yeah, well, Conrad's another one. Like this, Nabokov as well. Like, there's people that write not in their first language better than, not better. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, fantastic work, really. I just like it because you get everything. You get different perspectives. You get different views, it's just another of those things of why is it got to be better or worse or different? It's just another stories. You know what I mean? More and more.
No, I was going to say, I think it's definitely, well, obviously, you know, as a speaker of English as a second language, it's right on my street, but I think it's a very interesting topic because, you know, when you're translating, like working as a translator, sometimes you don't realize, or when you read the English text, you know, it might seem okay. But then when you actually try to translate into Spanish, then you realize that it's shortcomings. So, you know, what things should be or could be clearer and so on. So when you're writing in English as a second language, you're constantly kind of like doing that process. So So I was very excited to read about it, because it is true that it's a very interesting process that doesn't happen if you're a native and when you're writing in your own language, you know, whether it's English, Spanish or whatever. You don't pay so much attention to all the details and you take things for granted. And then, you know,
do you not when think as well, Maria, I think when you speak in two languages, you're like, I sometimes think, wow, in English, I'm a different, you have a kind of a slightly different personality. Like, I don't speak, obviously my Spanish isn't as good as my English and written worse. So my personality changes because I have to use different language to express myself. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It's like two different, it's even two different voices. Like when you speak with a higher or lower voice I find it really, and then if you get to the level of idioms and things like that, you choose different idioms and, I don't know. For me, it's fascinating, the whole thing. And of course, if I compare it to what, like, I always think, wow, like the level of being able to write a story in a language that isn't your own or a poem is incredible for me.
I think we've mentioned this in the podcast before in the past, and I think both Ben and I have spoken about this thing of like this alter ego that you end up creating when you're speaking in the other language, and sometimes even like maybe if you're a bit shy, you actually feel more confident in the other language because you're not hearing, you know, you cannot hear yourself, so you have less prejudice against what you're saying, maybe.
I agree totally. It's a weird, weird thing.
Yeah, it's kind of fascinating and weird at the same time. Actually, you know, this is going very meta because we're in an interview and we also wanted to ask you about an interview. Because in the Madrid Review, which is your newest project, which we're going to talk about a little bit later, you interview a lot of people as well. Now you're being an interviewee, but you actually interview a lot of people there. So why do you find, what is it that you like about interviewing? Why do you find it interesting?
Oof, good question. Why do I find it interesting? That wasn't what I expected. I thought you were going to say, how do you do it? I don't know. Why do I find it? Well, I guess to hear the opinions of the other people, meaning, a lot of the time you kind of hear the same stories. You guys must hear this. Now a lot of the stories, like writers or they tend to have a similar story, published or not, you know, that they start very young, they read, they sort of read voraciously anything, you know, like all types of books, maybe write, kind of enjoy English or whatever it is, literature or lingua or whatever. And history or whatever, things like that, read a lot, write stories for their friends, kind of introverted, touchy, artistic, you know, like it's always the same kind of story. That part is interesting for me to hear the same, you know, so you kind of feel like, oh, you're not alone, you know. For me, it's a type of, there's a kind of creative type as well. Like I see it in schools a lot, that it's kind of writing is their first language, like speaking is their second language sometimes. We learn as you get older, you know. I think as a child you can be more introverted because you read a lot and you have your own imagination a lot. So you either can be extrovert or you can socialize. But sometimes I think the kind of creative types look a bit weird, odd. But that's the kind of artistic type. You learn as you get older how to deal with it and how to relate to people and cover it up and what you can say and what you can't say. But I think that side of it is really interesting for me, and to know what was their process. You know, they have strong relationships with books. They love books, the smell of them and that side. And then also the other side, I love the differences. So I love finding out, when do people write? What do they do? How do they deal with, because sometimes it's when it's a famous person, how do they deal with fame? You know, some of these people sold 11 million books, like the John Boyne. I was like, how do you feel when you, it must be such a weird thing to happen to you that everybody, it's kind of the writer's dream. Now you get on the train and or the metro and everyone's reading your book, or but is it so good? Or then do you have to do that book again? Or so I don't know, there's always an aspect of it. And I also think that writers always want to talk, you know, so there's always creative people always want to talk. I think I just find them interesting. I don't find actors very interesting. I don't find, you know, I love football, but watching interviews about football, I find awful. Politicians, I'm not that interested. But artistic people, I can sit and watch hours of it. I don't know why. I just find it fascinating. Just, I'm a weirdo for that kind of thing. I love it. Poets talking about poetry, I'll just sit there. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Love it. Just an interest.
I say a lot of writers are just lonely, you know, they spend so much time on their own. So when they talk, it's a pleasure for them.
I agree. But you know what's worse? Translating. Like, I don't know, you were talking about it, Maria, but my wife's a translator, and that's a lonely job as well. Mm-hmm. Like, writing is the thing with writing. I agree with you, Ender. They want to talk, writers, because they're stuck on their own with all these people. Imagine. And I don't know about you guys, but if I say to my wife, oh, I had a brilliant idea, because we're always having ideas now that you see someone or something and it's like, oh, but what if I say that to my wife, she just glazes over, you know, like, oh God, no, please, no, not another book idea. You know, don't tell me that. So writers are always, you have to keep it in your head. You make notes everywhere. You're linking things up. You're thinking about this book and then you rush to the end. Like, you know what it's like, crazy. So someone actually wants to ask you, it's like, oh, yeah, I'll talk about it.
One thing you mentioned a little bit earlier as well in your previous answer is like interviewing people, you get to hear variations of the same thing, perhaps. And that's interesting that there's this commonality, perhaps. And in our podcast, I think we have found that where there's a lot of people who are teachers like ourselves and they have a project that they do that is interesting. So what I've noticed about your two projects, the Tint Journal and the Madrid Review, is that you have access to amazing people like John Boyne. Both websites look amazing. I've seen a picture of the print edition of the Madrid Review as well. It's gorgeous. It looks so nice as well. So for all those like teachers out there who like teaching, but they want to do something else that maybe sparks their inspiration and their imagination, do you have any advice for them in terms of like how to get something off the ground? Because clearly you have a talent for this kind of stuff, you know?
No, I wouldn't say like this is something that's worked, but I've done a million things that haven't worked. Huh? Like, so the thing is, for example, with this one, and some people have told me this since, I just thought, I've seen lots of lit mags online now, like on Twitter or X or whatever it's called. I've sent poetry to them, published poetry in a couple of them, and I just got this feeling of like, wow, I wouldn't mind. Like, there should be one. Imagine doing one. And then I thought, oof. So I asked around, and then some people are like, well, I don't know, I'm a bit busy and what? And I'm not really a bossy person. I'm not. Like, so I thought, I'll try. I'll try. Because there isn't one, you know, there's the Paris Review, the New York Review of Books, the London. I'm like, the Madrid Review sounds good. Where is it? Do you know what I mean? It should be there. And so I thought, well, I'll do it. And to be fair, like normally the first advice would be if the old classic, you know, like it's like if there isn't a book that you want, that you want to read a book that isn't there, you have to write it, which probably I've found out. The problem is sometimes nobody else wants to read it either, but that's fine. Like, so, but you've written it, you've got it out of your head. This one for me didn't feel like work, felt like a hobby. And I thought, well, I'll just have a go. I'll just have a go. I can see how other people are doing it. You invite submissions. And then I thought, well, I did. I don't know if you guys have suffered this, but if you're marketing a book or something like that, it's horrendous. You've got to sell yourself all the time. And it's embarrassing. Or I don't know if you can do it. Some people have a talent for it, but it's constant social media now and crowing about yourself. But if it's something that's secondary to you, so for example, your company or a podcast or this magazine, it's another thing. It's not me saying, hey, look at this, look at me, I wrote this, or please read my book. And the criticism when it comes isn't at you directly. You know, I hated it. I loved it. I didn't like it. This was good. This was rubbish. And it kind of, I didn't care. I was like, well, I'll try. And then I got lucky because I got an interview with Santiago Postiguillo and Paul Preston, Paul Preston as well, who both said yes. Like I wrote to them, contacted them. Both said yes. I mean, you know, guys, when you ask people, I just thought, well, I'll go for the ones I want, you know, like a couple of names. Mm-hmm. I thought I want a couple of names and I want, I had another friend who agreed to do book reviews. He works in the book trade, Cliff, and he was like, I can get some advanced copies. And he loves books. He's very, he just got, I got a feeling off him as well. Like, oh yeah, he's up for this, you know, same as me. And then if anybody, I asked a couple of other friends and anybody that was like, well, maybe, I mean, what's it like? Are we going to get paid? Are we going to, well, no, you know, of course not, you know. I mean, no, in a nice way, but you know, you get this feeling of like, okay, yes, no, yes, no. And got a nice little group. And then got nice people, like you said, a lot of famous, I don't know if you found this, but the more famous people are, the nicer they tend to be, and the less famous, the more difficult they can be. So I think famous people have seen it all the way up. They know what's going on. They've seen the industry as well. Like you guys have worked in publishing. Now you've seen it from more angles than just below. You know, so I think they see it as a different thing. Like if you, for example, I look up when people have books coming out. Recently, Joanne Harris had a book, a new book out, The Chocolate Lady, the author. So I asked her, look, can we do something for your book the same time it comes out? And of course, she's like, yeah, great. No, for her, it's great. And for me, it was lovely that I had an interview with her. So I'm rambling now, guys. Sorry.
No. It's fascinating because I think what you said, like we always say to people, we interviewed Irina Vallejo because she's the most famous person we've done. But I bring her up here because she actually was also one of the nicest. She was so generous with her time. And as you said, like we have found as well with her and other people with various levels of success that the higher they are, the nicer they tend to be.
Yeah.
Just with her career in general as well, like I think she every so often publishes a book with a small publisher as a way to promote that small publisher. So that is absolutely incredible. And just like as you said, it's like selling yourself, myself and Maria yesterday, we went to three bookshops to try and get a book that we've published for another guy stocked. And before going to each one, there's that little kind of mentally steeling yourself, okay, let's just go in and have this conversation because you're worried about the rejection, but actually we're so relieved that each person treated us so nicely in each workshop. It was just like a relief, you know, just to be well treated, you know, when you're selling yourself like that.
I think then you get the feeling, you also get that feeling of okay, like that yesterday with you guys at the bookshop, you suddenly think, come on, we can do this. You just have to go in and do it. And people are nice in general, if you're nice, you know, I mean, that's the rule. It's one of the rules of life. Sometimes they're not, but you know what I mean? You have to trust that. Also, if you take a knockback when it comes, I think you take a knockback and learn from it. You know, if you were wrong, you're wrong. If you weren't wrong, you carry on. No, I don't know.
Yeah, I think you said a lot of interesting things there because, well, obviously we can empathize with that. And sometimes maybe you just don't ask because you think, well, I mean, you know, there's just no way this person is going to talk to you. And then as you say, well, you think, okay, I want to go for this person. I'll just try. And many times it doesn't work, but others it does. And I think I'm interested in what you said is... because you were talking about like being kind of like two different people when you're talking in two different languages. And this almost felt like, you know, another version of that because, or I don't know if you agree, because, you know, you are one person, maybe the creative type of person maybe is more, well, not necessarily, but like you said, like maybe it's like lonely or I don't know, there's more... in their own world, but then obviously when you're trying to do this sort of thing you have to be a lot more extrovert and be forward, sell yourself. So do you think it is the case that you also end up kind of like having these two personas? You reminded me a little bit of teaching as well, because at the end of the day, when you're teaching, you also become, you know, this other person that is like a bit of an entertainer.
For me, it's life, you know? Like, how many people are you? I'm at least 5 or 6. You know what I mean? Like, it depends. Like, at school, I'm Mr. James. And Mr. James, I quite like him. He's all right. He's good to me. But it's a particular way I have to be at school, you know? The writing guy, I don't know. Now I'm quite used to him. And that feels like the real me, maybe. But he doesn't really speak. Then I'm the husband. I'm the dad now, you know? Dad is like a pain to be. Like, it's horrible. But you have to be that. You know, the same people, some people put you in or try and put you into a role sometimes. That's the big thing. And as you get older, you accept it or you don't. No, some people want you to be, you feel them putting you in a kind of, they think that you're this, so you're going to be this. And but that's humans, I think. It's an interesting thing. There's loads, you have many different selves. The weird thing with the me, this me that's talking to you now, crazy. This me that's talking to you, the sort of James, the editor, that guy, is a bit like, it's just me normally. This is a bit me, and I feel like normal me, because this is also the way that I'm trying to do the magazine at the moment, trying to be human and myself, because I'm not doing it for money. It's not to be paid. It's a hobby, and I don't want to go into kind of, I don't know how you'd say it, like starting with the not categorizing, but you start going into very highbrow, or I don't know. At the moment, I just want to keep it very open and kind of human. I don't know how to describe it. Like, it's the same thing as the poetry. When I read it, if I decided the first issue, because of course, when you see it from the other side, you guys must know this. You suddenly get these manuscripts, and wow, it's quite a responsibility to have to suddenly. I mean, you have your subjective response, which is, "Oh, I like this," or "I don't." But then you have this other level of, "Oh my God, now I've got to tell someone I don't like it, or I don't want it," or, and it is quite a hard thing, no, like to tell someone or to think I don't like that. But you have to make a decision. Well, I like this, or I think this is good, or I think this will sell, or I think other people will be interested in this. I think that's a thing that comes with the magazine or with receiving things. Guys, I'm sorry about the noise in the background. The guy is now cutting the grass right outside my window.
I don't
know if you can hear that.
Don't worry. It adds color to the podcast, you know? People can imagine themselves in this Spanish soundscape. We just came across you recently. We're definitely going to put links to both your journals and magazines in the description so people can follow you. Honestly, we're both big fans of what you're doing, and we wish you the best of luck in particular.
I love what you guys are doing too. I was looking through the books yesterday. The one about the creators is amazing, and Seamus Heaney's trip as well. Do you guys write together then?
We do.
Yes, we do.
Really? How does that work?
Well, Maria, how's it working for you?
This is James. This is like a number one question we get asked.
But it works. It works for you guys.
I do the dictation, she does the typing. That's how we
do it. Oh, shut up. No, I mean, it works well. It sort of ties in with, you know, I'm sure you'll perfectly understand it, because after what we've been discussing for the whole podcast, I mean, you know, when you have like-minded people and you sort of like what they write and understand why they write and kind of like know why they write it the way they write it and have translated them and so on, like we have each other, then it just, you know, it just comes naturally and what.
It's like a dream. That's like a dream for me, though, that you've got someone that you can write with who you actually both connect. I always think that, you know, when you hear about the old Hollywood films where they sit in a room, or I don't know, friends or something, where they all sit and they kind of bang out scripts and plots, and this one says, oh, but what about, because normally I do that with myself, which isn't fun, you know, but if you do it with somebody else and you respect their opinion and you respect their writing, that must be amazing. I'm jealous, basically.
Well, if you ever want to write a book with us in the future, we can do it all the time. Six hands in the book.
Be collective.
But James, let me say, it's been a huge pleasure having you here. Thank you so much.
Honestly, thank you so much, guys. Thanks for having me. Good luck with everything with the books.
Thank you. Likewise, James.